Hello, everyone. I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome back to season 4 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
So now we'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Eve and I are recording. Wait for it, this live special event, a live recording of Archive Fever, direct from Adelaide Writers Week. There you go. Now you know we're live. We've got a live audience. So we would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people on whose land we are recording, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded. We acknowledge Kaurna elders, past and present, and thank them for welcoming us to their beautiful country here today.
And we'd also like to thank this big Adelaide crowd for turning up today for this very Peak Nerd podcast. It's incredible to think that we're launching into our fourth season already with our pod squad of loyal listeners and fellow archive addicts out there. Just goes to show that methodology and epistemology are really very, very fun.
Indeed. And today we are lucky to share the stage with two fellows who are working at the coalface of archival collection and management, challenging traditional Eurocentric methodologies and epistemologies in ways that are at once radical and beautiful. So let's introduce our beautiful, radical archive nerds. First, to my right, is Dr. Jared Thomas. Jared is a Nukuna person of the Southern Flinders Ranges and the curator of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art and material culture at South Australia Museum. Apart from his work as a curator, he is a celebrated author of fiction for children, as well as a playwright. His books include Calypso Summer and Songs That Sound Like Blood, as well as the Game Day series co-authored with Olympic basketball legend Paddy Mills. In 2019, Jared received a Churchill Fellowship to investigate colonised peoples' interpretive strategies in permanent gallery displays in America, Canada, New Zealand, and Norway. Jared is currently a member of the Australia Council for the Arts Aboriginal Strategic Initiatives Panel, a board member of Arts Law, as well as an ambassador for the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, and a consultant to ABC television shows such as Stateless and Operation Buffalo. Welcome to Archives Anonymous, Jared.
Thank you.
And to my left, we have Professor John Carty. Carty is a Professor of Museum and Curatorial Studies at the University of Adelaide and Head of Humanities at the South Australian Museum, where he's responsible for the most significant collections of Aboriginal art and cultural heritage in the world. He's also Humanities and Social Sciences Commissioner for the Australian National Commission to UNESCO. John has worked extensively with Aboriginal artists and custodians throughout Australia on books, exhibitions, and community development programs, including the recent Balgo exhibition, which many of you here in Adelaide would have seen. His core research has involved working with Aboriginal artists to bridge the divide between anthropology and art history. In recent years, John's work through research with the British Museum, National Museum of Australia, and now the South Australian Museum, has grown to focus on the cultural and cross-cultural histories encompassed by objects in museum collections. His projects explore new methodologies and models for bringing Aboriginal voices and values further into mainstream narratives of Australian history, research, and culture. John's books include Beyond Borders, co-edited with Hetty Perkins, and the recently released Balgo, Creating Country, which is absolutely superb. So a smoking hot archive fever welcome to you too, John.
Okay, so Jared, here at Archive Fever, we like to think we provide a safe space to discuss our addictions. It's just you, me, Eve, John, and our thousand or so of our closest friends here in front of us and our legions of fans out there in Podland. So I'd like to start by asking you a question we ask all our guests. When did your love of research first start? How did you get bitten by the research bug?
Yeah, well, it was very early. And looking at archive, I look at a whole range of different texts as archives. So there's objects, there's place, there's written documents, etc., and then there's people and story. So for me, it was very young, growing up in Port Augusta. So to place a context, my dad's family are Nukuna and Nadri, and there's a little bit of Swiss in there, and then mum's family are Koa from Queensland, and a nice bit of kind of Viking stuff. So just with dad's family growing up in Port Augusta, and as a kid, there wasn't much like commercial television, and I was really interested in South Africa and apartheid, and recognised there was a type of apartheid in the town that I grew up within. And looking at my grandfather's experiences, trying to understand the poverty that was around me and that racism. So dad would, when I was younger, he would kind of try to keep the hard stories from me. But as a teenager, he started to share more of those stories. And often he would tell me them when there was a northerly kind of whipping up, a big storm, lightning. And I think because it was that moment and to keep me kind of suspended and the theatre, he started to tell me more about, you know, his childhood, my grandfather's experiences, etc. So my fascination with the archive came out of that, trying to understand the context that I was embedded in and those of my parents, my grandfathers, my Aboriginal family. I wanted to understand how in the hell did we get to that point. So that was really it.
And when did you realise that you could turn that personal and familial interaction and engagement with the oral archive into a profession?
Okay, well, maybe I've got to talk about a couple of things, because there's my creative writing, then there's my work in museums and working to support artists as well. But for quite a while with my family, because I was only 16 when I enrolled at Adelaide University. So I left Port Augusta, enrolled, and my undergraduate major was anthropology. And we all knew that at some stage I might get called up to provide evidence for native title. So for a long time, my family said, let's not look at the non-Indigenous texts about our people. They knew they were there, but it was like, we're going to speak to you and you're going to be handed down this information in the normal way, okay? Because when I went to give native title, if I'd read those documents, it would have diminished my authority as a Nukuna person. So in 2013, I gave evidence for 3.5 days to the court throughout Nukuna country. And then in 2019, we were successful with that native title case, and just recently, February 3rd this year, we got the remainder of our native title.
Congratulations.
And then my family said, now you can go and look at the Tyndale records. Now you can look at Elkin. Now you can look at Mountford. So, and then once by the time I entered that information, it was really incredible to see that what I've been told by my great aunties, uncles, etc., was reflected in those texts.
So the research bug for you was both a personal affliction but also a social responsibility.
It's political, it's personal responsibility. And so then I guess, you know, like my first creative writing work, a play called Flash Red Ford about my great-grandfather's experiences in Port Augusta at the Mission, did some research that was produced in Kenya and Uganda. And then when I went on to write fiction, so I write predominantly young adult fiction, but it's always embedded with Nukuna historic content. Yeah, so it's coming from a whole I don't know. I couldn't stop it if I wanted to, really.
Like a true addict. And what about you, John? Did you come out of the womb as an archive addict, or was there a particular moment that transformed you?
I think I might have come out of the womb in this way. But it's funny listening to Jared. He's someone I work really closely with. We know each other really well. To hear him say that, you know, it started at this moment where he thought, how the hell did we get here?
Mm.
And I thought, wow, I had that same moment as a non-Aboriginal person, as a young guy with all the privilege in the world, you know. I was at a university in Melbourne. I was studying art. I was studying the art of cultures around the world and suddenly realised that I knew nothing about my own country. And I'd gotten through all of the hoops of education that you can have in Australia with all of the privilege to get there. And I knew nothing about my own country. And I was maybe 22, 23 at this point. I just finished uni and I had my midlife crisis right then and there and realised I was completely ignorant and that I was living inside these silences about the history of Australia and my own place here that was impossible to live with. And that sparked... I guess the short answer, this idea that I needed to then use the tools that I had to fill those silences and to orient myself in relationship to Aboriginal Australia in a completely different way. And that research was my way in.
And what does it feel like for you when you're sort of in the grip of a particular archive? On Archive Fever, we like to talk about the kind of experiential embodied dimensions for you.
Well, I think I probably get turned on by a slightly different kind of archive than some of you history nerds. I'm not a historian in the classic sense, and that the archive that has transformed me and that has completely transformed the way I think and my values and the way that I operate in the world is actually being out on country with Aboriginal people and realizing that the great texts of our continent. The great texts in the world really are written in the landscape. They're written in the cultures of Aboriginal people that endure today. And so when I'm out on country, when Jared takes me to his country or where some of the you know, my friends and family in Balgo take me to country, I feel in the presence of the greatest archive of all. And I find that I find something very beautiful and fulfilling as an Australian to be animated by that archive.
We tend to think of archival finds as kind of exciting, spine-tingling moments of discovery, you know, the kind of eureka moments of research that keep us coming back for more. But your fellow's day jobs, it seems to me, proves that's not always the case. I think it's fair to say, and you've told us now very clearly and beautifully, that what you do together and individually is expand the idea of what constitutes the archive in the first place. And we'll get some of the implications of that work, in particularly in relation to Aboriginal knowledge systems, a bit later. But I'd like to take you firstly to a particular collection in the South Australian Museum. This is the collection of Indigenous remains held by the museum in what Guardian journalist Paul Daly has described as the room of the dead. I don't want to appear voyeuristic here, but I want to read his description of that space because it's a place that not many people will get access to, and I think that it will give listeners quite a visceral sense of the issues that we're dealing with here. So Daly writes, "This halfway house for bones and spirits feels too small for all it harbours. For stored here in thousands of cardboard containers are the full or partial skeletal remains of 4,600 individuals and the millions of human experiences attached to them. You wander past the shelves and glance at the boxes. The contents of a few are denoted in a neat calligraphic hand, femur, jaw. Some bear a word or two scrawled in biro, skull, ground bone, human rib, child, cranium, mandibles. Others are marked with only a place name, Minleton, Cape Elizabeth, Salt Creek, or the name of a people such as the Kaurna, custodians of the country that became Adelaide and who feature disproportionately on the shelves. Jared, can you tell us what it's like for you to be in that room, a site that's part of your workplace?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a regular day in a library manuscripts collection, is it?
Yeah, well, just my engagement with the Humerian Main. So I was first, you know, there's my job at the museum now, but there's me as a Nookana person who's been engaging with the museum for a long time. So I was first contacted nearly 20 years ago by a staff member at the museum who had identified 20 Nookana people, my ancestors. So to go to work in an institution where I know 20 of my ancestors are on a shelf of that institution, it's very, very challenging and unsettling. And then for me as a, like, being in my 20s and having that responsibility to work with my community to guide, to partly guide them through and then guide me through that process of repatriation back to country. So my people and what I know of my people, but there's probably other people in that in there that are also related to me, it's really, really unsettling. At the same time, you know, we know that some of those people are there through really dreadful circumstances. In other cases, it's just part of South Australian policy, which I'll get John to speak to more. The reason why Aboriginal people are there, particularly Ghana. Like, how many people are there in this audience that live in Adelaide? How many people have displaced Ghana people or built their homes in Ghana land? So through that kind of development, that's where a lot of those human remains were unearthed and placed in the museum. But, yeah, it's very challenging. Also, you know, my family are really interested in what those remains can tell us about ourselves, our past, our history.
So, John, let's get to that point that Jared said he wanted to throw to you. I guess the first thing we need to know is how the bones came to be at the museum and what's the story that this collection tells us.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of sad roads that lead to that keeping place. And there's the roads that are familiar to, or should be familiar to most of us, which are the ones we drive on. You know, there are 4,500 ancestors on shelves in the museum because of Adelaide, if you want the short answer. The roads we drive on, the houses we live in, the parks we stroll through, were all burial places. They were all living places. And so Aboriginal bones were disturbed in the building of this town and the lives that we lead. That's the majority. But there's also this other darker undercurrent to Adelaide, which is the relationship between the medical fraternity, the university, the museum, to actually go and dig up Aboriginal remains as part of the racist Darwinian kind of science that was seeking to identify Aboriginal people as sitting somewhere back on the spectrum of human development. And museums across the world were trading Indigenous remains in order to prove this point, which we now see as both comically stupid and deeply racist. But at the time, 100 years ago, and well into the 20th century, really senior scientists in Adelaide were going out and disturbing Aboriginal gravesites. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have this responsibility. And that is effectively the story of Australia, which is the dehumanising of Aboriginal people to be specimens for Western science. And, you know, to reflect on that the start of that question of what does it feel like? You know, when I came to the South Australian Museum, I was coming to work with the greatest collection in the world, the most important collection of Aboriginal material culture in the world. I knew there'd be some repatriation required, and that was part of the job. I didn't understand at all the scale, and I think that I would be lying to think that I came here fully understanding the weight of that. So when I first walked into that room, I still remember how it felt. I still remember sitting down with myself and crying that afternoon and thinking, you are not allowed to forget how this feels. This standing in this room is everybody's turned their face away from this for 100 years. Everyone who's worked in the museum, everyone who's... It's just so hard. Good people have turned away from it because it's just too hard to deal with. And I think that the real challenge for me and for us as a team was to say, well, we have to be the ones who don't turn away from this, who take responsibility for addressing our history and for taking this really sad archive off the shelves and back into country.
So can you tell us a bit more about that repatriation work that you're doing that's bringing those, taking those ancestors back to country?
Yeah, well, look, I think after having that quite existential moment when I started, it became clear that the priority of the South Australian Museum needed to become repatriation.
Yeah.
Not just making exhibitions and telling stories and sharing the extraordinary stories of Aboriginal culture with the world, but a profound practice of truth-telling and restitution. And so what we did is we've now refocused the museum very much on repatriation, and the challenge with different groups around South Australia to rebury ancestors with Aboriginal groups, it's sometimes easier in smaller numbers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can bury one ancestor in that sandhill where they belong, and that's a very quiet and beautiful thing to do. But for Kaurna people, on whose land we sit right now, those places are gone. Yeah. Those spaces are gone. You can't rebury 800 of your ancestors here in the middle of town because those spaces are no longer available to you. So what we've had to do, and it's a really, some of you will have seen it on the news for audiences here in Adelaide and maybe some of the podcast listeners as well. We had to create a new place to deal with our history. We had to build a burial ground in the north of Adelaide called Wangiyata. And that was a process that was led by Madge Wanganeen and the Kaurna leaders here in Adelaide with our support to build a place where you could bring the ancestors back and put them to rest so that they don't spend another 100 years on the shelf. And I think that we do that in smaller ways with different groups around Australia and around South Australia, but I think that is the expression of, I guess, looking at the hardest possible thing in our professional orbit and saying, how do we do that? And it was a pretty amazing and emotional moment last year in December when we were able to do the first reburials of that burial ground. It's pretty special.
Jared, do you think there should be a national keeping place? I mean, obviously South Australian Museum is kind of leading the charge on divesting itself of its more problematic collections, but should this be something that is carried out as a matter of course nationally?
Yeah, well, I mean, there needs to be resourcing to Aboriginal people. So I don't know about being in favour of, like, making another collection space per se, but maybe in the interim because, yeah, I mean, so many communities, we want our objects to be returned, but for my community, we think our objects are, I'm not talking about human remains here, we want them home as soon as possible, but it's not so easy, even for people in regional areas. So there's so much pastoralism development. We don't necessarily want them placed in graveyards. So with Nukuna, for example, most Nukuna people were buried at Port Germain and they couldn't be buried in the cemetery because it was considered like hallowed land and, we didn't have that privilege. So, again, a whole lot of kind of hurdles. How do we have resourcing to get people back to country? So that is a national responsibility. And in terms of objects, we feel our objects are safest in the South Australian Museum because there's a whole lot of measures to humidity, light, fire, water, protections, etc. We can't just take them back to the Melrose Museum. We don't have a Nukuna Museum. And the type of resourcing to make that possible. So it is a challenge. But in some cases, there are materials where, like wood is very difficult, wood and hair is very difficult to preserve. The South Australian Museum possesses a 10,000-year-old boomerang. Our job is to ensure that all objects exist in another 10,000 years. So there's some really interesting ethical preservation questions. It's not so straightforward.
And John, my understanding is that as part of the national repatriation protocols, any human remains that are returned to South Australia from overseas collections, because, of course, the British Museum, and you can talk a bit more about that where other ones are, must go to the South Australian Museum's collection before they can be returned to country. So does that mean that the museum's bone collection is actually growing?
So there's a couple of points there. One is, like, so the British Museum or museums in Germany overseas can return ancestors directly to the Ghana. Mm-hmm. Often Ghana will, or other groups will ask the museum to be the safe house, the transition place, rather than the end point for their ancestors. Mm-hmm. There's enough trust now that we're becoming that transitional zone where we can treat with those museums and be the safe place, and then Ghana or other groups will do their reburials. So those museums don't have to deal directly with us. Mm-hmm. They can, so that's a. There's a lot of Aboriginal ancestors overseas, based on that trade that I was mm-hmm. talking about earlier. That needs to. There's a whole lot of restitution to go on there. I did want to pick up though, just this sense of just picking up on the keeping place question. Mm-hmm. I think that there's obviously a need for, and when we say a keeping place, we mean a place like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier where unprovenanced ancestors who we can't return to country because we don't know exactly where their country is, that there is a place for them to be remembered and held safely, not on museum shelves. So there's an argument to have one in Canberra, and that's been well argued for by Aboriginal leaders. There are equal numbers of unprovenanced remains in South Australia. We need to build a keeping place here. There needs to be a keeping place in Perth, in Melbourne. There needs to be, in every city of Australia, a place where ancestors are safe and where Aboriginal people can go to remember them and where white people can go to be reminded, you know, of our own place in that history. So I don't think it's a case like South Australian Aboriginal leaders don't want to send ancestors to Canberra. Mm. Like, that makes no sense. You're sending them further away from country. So it may be that we keep them here, and that's an argument for Aboriginal leaders to explore, but we definitely think there needs to be that all over Australia.
And John, you're doing this repatriation work, this work of challenging colonial institutions and knowledge systems from within the anthropology profession, which was, of course, the profession that did a lot of this harm in the first place. So in a way, you're sort of undoing the work of your white predecessors. Can you tell us, I suppose, about your relationship to anthropology as a profession these days? Like, can it be a force for good, or is it kind of inherently bound up in the colonial project?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I'm not a very good anthropologist. I don't think anyone in the profession would claim me in that way. I am actually undoing a lot of what my predecessors have done or seeking to do with my Aboriginal collaborators. But I also think anthropologists were the only people who went out and gave a shit about Aboriginal people for the 20th century. For all of the difficult things that anthropologists did and all of the things that we're unwinding or decolonising or questioning, who else was going out and actually listening to Aboriginal people and recording Aboriginal people and paying attention and learning the languages of Aboriginal people? So I think as we decolonise and as we critique anthropology in museums, it's also really important that the general public don't defer their blame mm-hmm. onto anthropology in museums. Nobody was paying attention. And if anthropologists made some mistakes and did some racist or horrible things, there's no need to smooth that over. We're not in the business of whitewashing it. But I'm also really resistant to the idea that everyone else was doing a great job in Australia and we should target the anthropologists.
Although, John,
sorry.
Do you mind if I...
Yeah,
I think,
you know, I have
but
to.
I do think that, you know, those representations of Aboriginal people, often by anthropologists, because they were leading the representation of us. So, you know, when you look at people like Tyndall in the South Australian Museum, how we were framed, and you can still go into the museum today, and what it shows is over here we're violent, over here we use drugs and alcohol, over here we can't cook. And that is not the story of our people. So, you know, I think in terms of that decolonization, it is being like deeply critical of the archive and how it's been used and framed to construct, yeah, this understanding of Aboriginal people and the outcome for us as Aboriginal people.
Mm. Yeah, so anthropologists were gathering the data about Aboriginal people, but in doing so they created these really racist narratives often, yeah.
Yeah.
So you've touched on this point and this word a few times now, decolonising the museum. Let's explore that a bit further, what it actually means. I mean, it's work that you are consciously doing. But I'm curious to know, John, maybe you can take this one. Is everything in a 19th century museum in a settler society like Australia, is it by its nature, is the collection by its nature colonial? So what I mean is, does decolonising an institution like the South Australian Museum necessitate a root and branch overhaul of the entire collection? Can all archives be decolonised?
That's a super question. We need a whole series of podcasts on that one. I think Jared will have some views on this, and I'll make mine therefore succinct. I have a great conviction and sympathy and empathy with the process of decolonisation, and I would hope that in 100 years' time people look back at this era of the South Australian Museum and say, look, they were trying to do the unpicking that is required to keep the story evolving, and that Aboriginal people were leading that process at the South Australian Museum in really powerful ways. So I'm a supporter of that decolonial process, but I also, through working in the museum every day, I'm very conscious that it is one of the great resources for Aboriginal people, whether it be through Stolen Generations, Native Title, or cultural reclamation that exists in the world, which is why that tension with anthropology is so live. Yeah, Tyndale went out in a way and collected all this stuff, and there's lots of issues with that. But it is this most extraordinary resource for cultural renewal and for empowerment and elevation of Aboriginal voices that I've ever seen. So it's really hard for me to sit simply back and say, decolonise, decolonise. Because I think what's clear to me after researching the collections is that there are collections in there that were created by Aboriginal people and were archived with Tyndale or with the museum for the purposes of preservation. There's a man called Millerum who archived all of the Ngurrindjeri songs and weaving techniques and practices. He archived his whole culture. There's literally shelves dedicated to Millerum in our archives and in our collections. He was using the museum for a different purpose. He was imagining a museum that would serve his descendants. He was archiving in a way we haven't yet found a decent language for. Mm. And you can't decolonize that without undermining its intention. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's what I resist, even though I'm a great supporter of decolonization, is a blanket term that loses the nuance of and the agency and the power of some of those great Aboriginal leaders who used museums really, really thoughtfully in the past, and that we need to be learning from that and paying attention to that and thinking about the indigenisation of museums rather than simply the decolonisation of them.
Oh, that's a fantastic idea, and the agency that went into the collection and the creation in the first place. So, Jared, does what John's talking about here link to an idea that I've seen you refer to before, which is the idea of the cultural seed bank? So that the ways in which collections can help Aboriginal people remember and reconnect with whole systems of thought and knowledge and skill.
Yeah, so I want to just talk a bit about what John's touched on, and that, you know, museums are very they're complex spaces, and you know there are those kind of the trophy cabinet of imperialism. With my own family, there's like acquisitions, commissions of objects from as early as the 1920s. So a lot of Aboriginal people had agency in terms of placing objects in the museum, knowing that it could be a good space for our people to reference them. But you've got to look at, like, who's controlling, what is the access, and what is the interpretation? So who is controlling the access and the interpretation? And often it's not Aboriginal people. So, you know, I will so often be with elders, people that I know have incredible cultural knowledge, they've never stepped foot into the South Australian Museum or the collections. So some of those objects have been on the shelf for 100 to 150 years. They step in. It's the first time they're engaging, and these people are 60 or 70 years old. So for me, decolonisation is about access, right? Because even though the collection there and there's the agency of Aboriginal people that place the objects there, there hasn't been that continuity of engagement for Aboriginal people. So for me, decolonisation is all about that. So getting back to the seed back concept, you know, in Nukana culture, Widma is the dreaming and Dangara are individual stories relating to every entity. And of course, a lot of knowledge has been lost because the archive is the people and the great stress on those people, you know, and the displacement of people, etc. So one of my, you know, another responsibility is the restoration of land. So reviving ecosystems, whether that be terrestrial or ocean. So the museum and the objects, they tell us about dominant species of plants. The iconography on objects tell us about the flora and flora that are in particular areas. The towers is probably the greatest example of that. Yeah. So 400 sculptural objects. The museum possesses 380. So they were bought 100 years ago for £400, which was an outrage at the time. So they talk to Deary Country, and they're kind of like the Google Maps of the desert. But they tell us everything that is in that area across thousands of kilometres. So, you know, that's an example. But for me, there was an object that came into the museum about 4 years ago from a private donation. And the particular object identified the creek lines and also the key species that should be growing along those creek lines. Creek lines that have been completely damaged through sheep and wheat, essentially. So, yeah, the archive is huge in terms of its... yeah, it's significant for Aboriginal people and for us together to re-establish ecologies.
So this is what you're referring to when you talk about the ecological archive.
Yeah, because, the dreaming is the ecological archive. And where there's gaps in that, sometimes we can reinvigorate that knowledge through study of objects and other archival materials.
So even using that term reinvigorate, what's coming to mind, cultural seed bank... reinvigoration. I'm thinking about Bruce Pascoe's work and the way in which he is actually, sowing and reaping actual seeds
Can I give
now.
You another example?
Is that?
I'll give you another example. So my wife, she builds oyster reefs. Mm-hmm. So there was scientists at Adelaide Uni. They were interested in Aboriginal people. With reference to oyster in our language. And they were like, there's no oysters in South Australia. There were no native oysters. But picking up on this, they started to research, and a combination of maritime records and Aboriginal records found there were 1,500 kilometres of native oysters in South Australia that were dredged by the 1940s. So now they're sowing oysters in the lab, and they're depositing back in the Spencer Gulf. So they're rebuilding this complete ecology. So, you know, that is a combination of kind of Western maritime Aboriginal knowledge to reinvigorate a significant ecology.
And I think just I should say, like, all of these processes of learning and decolonising and so forth benefit everyone. But this particularly benefits all South Australians, I've got to say. The increasing the oyster populations here is a good thing for everyone.
Jared, I wanted to pick up what you said a moment ago about, for you, decolonisation meaning access. Could you expand a bit on what that would look like in practice? I mean, is it just the kind of the cultural exchange and the reinvigoration of the landscape that you're talking about? Is it more Indigenous people working in the museum and opening it up to their communities? What does that kind of access look like for you?
Probably people in all the positions that non-Aboriginal people occupy.
Yep.
So, watch out, John.
Just knock John off the stage. Yeah. Yep.
That's the plan.
But it's like, it's just, when you think about it, how many Aboriginal people have worked in our cultural institutions? And again, had that kind of control, being able to interpret our objects, etc. So that would be the key aspiration. So one day it would be nice if there's an Aboriginal director of the South Australian Museum. If there's types of resources, like when I look along North Terrace, I see the Adelaide Festival Centre, the Art Gallery, the museum, festivals, etc. So there's a whole lot of resourcing that goes into maintaining and developing non-Aboriginal cultural practice. Whereas Aboriginal people, we're the oldest continuous culture in the world, but what is the resourcing allocation? So it's about getting some equity, and that equity comes through, staffing, employment, ensuring that community members can travel to the museum, spend sufficient time, digitise objects, text, and be able to take that back to their own communities.
Yeah, so we need to put our money where our mouth is and seriously invest in this work, basically.
So is that a process of democratising the archive as much as it is about decolonising the institution? If there's more access for Indigenous people to occupy those positions, does that imply that there's going to have to be a kind of a different way in which professional accreditation is imbued, or the idea that you don't need professional accreditation to work? Like, there are a whole lot of structural barriers, it seemed to me, to exist there in terms of access, unless we really have a quite a revolutionary notion of what it takes to work in something that we now consider to be a state-run institution.
I think, there's so many Aboriginal people with PhDs and...
I'm not implying that there aren't. Yeah. If I seem to be doing that, I didn't mean to do so.
Yeah. So I think it's just about, so in part I think it is about relinquishing some power. Mm. And then, of course, looking at different points of access to enable people to work in that space. Mm.
I think the question of who is the expert here is actually at the heart of this question. Mm. There's different pathways to Aboriginal people coming to work in our museum right now, and not all of them you have to flow through a university. You know, some you do. You know, Jared's got a PhD. Mm. He's an expert at the height of his powers. But we also have other ways, and in fact, probably the most important people who come and work in our museum are elders and leaders who come from other parts of South Australia or from Ghana country or wherever, and teach us about our collections and spend time in the archives, informing us about what we are actually responsible for, because we don't know exactly what we're responsible for. We are not the experts in a lot of these systems that we're talking about, these knowledge systems, these epistemologies. I threw that in there for Eve. So I think that, you know, there is a relationship between who works in museums and power, and access and interpretation and power. And I think you can never lose sight of that question of power, who has it and how are you, and if I have it, how am I making sure other people have access to it? You know, and if Jared has it as an Aboriginal man, how does he make sure other Aboriginal groups get access to it through him? So that's the bigger question, I think, in unpicking these institutions is who are the experts and who has the power and how do you work with that and unpick that, including your own position potentially.
Well, let's talk about your position, the two of you together. We generally think of archival research in a very Eurocentric way as being a fairly solitary pursuit, you know, the researcher sitting alone in the dusty stacks or in the banal government repository, and clearly on-country research defies that image, but so does the way you two clearly work in tandem. I'd like to know how your collaboration as a researcher's work. Does it ascribe to the Yolngu idea of Balagalili, which means two ways learning, where you have something to teach each other, and your research process loops and feeds back. How do you work together? Jared?
Do you want to start that or do you want me?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we've been talking about is there's a huge degree of responsibility in the work that we do, and a lot of accountability. We're accountable to so many people and communities, Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal, our own families, the institution we work for. And there's a whole, you know, like I'm new to the a museum space. So there's so many skills that I learned from John, and I think there's a lot of just keeping each other accountable and challenging each other a bit as well. So we, you know, regularly have very, very deep personal discussions where we're talking about our practice and trying to keep each other safe, I think, in a very complex environment.
Yeah, and sometimes keeping each other safe is about being really honest, you know, with the other person and saying, look, you know, you haven't nailed this, or, you know, and Jared has had to pull me up. I've had to share things with him. It's about having, I guess, being able to look each other in the eye as an Aboriginal man, as a non-Aboriginal man, and say, we've chosen to be in this space and we're going to back each other. And that sometimes that involves having an argument or it involves being honest. That's fine. You know, there's not enough of that in Australia. Mm. And so I think... we come at this from such different angles, Jared and I, in our life histories, but I feel like we kind of, we can't do this alone. Neither of us has what it takes to do it alone. You need, particularly in this space, the idea that you just go and do research on your own is unthinkable, really. Like, we are only able to do what we do with each other, but also with other Aboriginal leaders, and I think that's the beautiful future of research in this space. But I think our relationship's also a really interesting one in that we probably have to underwrite each other's courage to stay in this difficult space. Like, it's really hard to do on your own, whether you're black or white. It's a really risky place to be in all the time. And I think to have someone that you can turn to and say, geez, I stuffed that up, or is that person's critique of what I just did fair, or, you know, I think it's a really powerful thing, like any relationship, to have someone who you can turn to and hold you in this difficult conversation.
Underwriting our courage, I love that expression.
The South Australia Museum is clearly, you know, quite a leader, I think, in this space, it's fair to say, of decolonising the institution and repatriating your materials, Indigenous remains particularly. I'm interested to know how that work, I suppose, has been received more broadly in Australia and in museum communities worldwide. You know, have you faced pushback? Have you inspired other institutions to do similar work? What are the kind of conversations that have been going on?
Well, I think, I mean, I hope we, as we say with the burial ground and with some of these things, I hope sometimes just showing people that something is possible is enough. So I think for us to come from being, you know, arguably one of the most conservative cultural institutions in the country to being, not perfect, far from perfect, as Jared can tell you on many days at the museum, but to be courageous, to say that this is the truth of our history and the only way forward is to tell it. I hope that gives courage to other institutions and makes normal the things that seemed impossible or normal or achievable the things that felt too difficult. I don't know yet. I think we're still in the early days. And I think if Jared and I are honest, we're still in the early days of doing it within our own institution. Mm. Like, this is a really old institution, you know, in Adelaide. So there's a lot to unpick. There's a whole history. There's a whole Australia to unwind in our daily practice. And so I think it'll be a long time before we know the impact of this work and how it's rippling out.
John, we're getting towards the end of our time, unbelievably. I feel like we could do a whole nother hour, but we're not going to be able to let you go without me talking a bit about this Balgo, okay? If only for the fact that I carried it over in my luggage and it took up half the weight of my suitcase.
We do have to talk about our book during Writers' Week, don't we?
Meant that I couldn't pack as many shoes as I would have wanted to because I had to put your book in there.
You could turn it into a great pair of shoes.
Clearly so much of the work that you do at the museum is onerous and challenging both emotionally and intellectually. But I want you to tell us about that day in 2019 when you opened an email, downloaded the attachments, clicked on the thumbnail images and realised that you were looking at photos found in a shipping container somewhere in the Kimberley.
Well, thank you for introducing another day in which I cried during my my professional practice, Claire. It's real. Archive fever is real, you know. You really push the buttons, don't you? So I think what Claire's referring to is, I guess, this Balgo, going back to an earlier question, Balgo is the first archive. It's the place where I learnt to unthink a lot of the ways that I thought about Australia. And the people there were my true educators. And, you know, whatever qualifications I have in museums and all this other guff, like Balgo is where my education happened. And I spent 20 years researching the art of the Balgo people, trying to understand the history of Aboriginal art, but also the history of Australia through it. But I could never finish that work because the first artworks were always missing. The first artworks that were painted in Balgo in the early 1980s had disappeared off the face of the earth. And so I was a bit paralysed. I felt like I couldn't tell that story until I'd found those works anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you to the other stage. They're enjoying this as well. In 2019, I got an email from someone in the government who'd got an email from someone in the Kimberley saying they'd found a bunch of paintings in a shipping container and they might be from Balgo. And could I have a look at them, please, and just, you know, let them know? And I clicked them open, burst into tears like a baby, and knew that they were all the first artworks from the beginning of the Balgo art movement, the most perfect, most beautiful expressions of the translation of the original archive, the Jukurpa, the dreaming, onto this cross-cultural plane of a painted board for the rest of us to reckon with. And so for me, that was the spark really to come back to this work I was doing and this book that I'd never finished and finally be able to finish it, because that first piece of the puzzle, you know, those early pages that had been ripped out of the story were able to be sewn back in.
I wish we had more time to discuss it. It's beautiful. I just want to read one line that you've written in there. You say, "I've spent my adult life trying to understand how a painting could be something more than a painting, how a country could be more than a place, how a painting, when you've learned how to look, reveals a whole world." I suppose I'd like to ask one final question to you, Jared, based on that sentence. Do you think all Australians can learn how to look, how to see country as more than a place? Will it take us all a lifetime?
No, it's not. I think people can get to that position very quickly if they take the time to really listen. Mm. So an understanding of culture, it's not about race. It's about actually... Yeah, just dropping the guard and making yourself vulnerable and listening and engaging genuinely with Aboriginal people.
Can I recommend this book to all of you? You don't have to put it in your overnight bags. You just have to get it home with you, and everybody listening out there to go. It is a beautifully produced book. The words will touch your heart and your soul. You will learn so much. It's a great story of archival hunting and digging and finding, and I really recommend it to you. We are going to have to wrap up, so we're going to end with the question that we pose to all of our guests in the Archive Fever. Now, do remember, this is a safe space. But we'd like to ask you both whether you have a dirty little archive secret that you'd like to share with us. John, you're chuckling.
There's just so many at the South Australian Museum. I don't know where to begin. I'll share one that isn't necessarily one of my foibles, but one of the many things that shocked me when I took over these collections, there was this collection of... Sorry, I'm just laughing at the story. There's this collection of pottery that was completely smashed. You know, there's these 30 pots from Papua New Guinea that were smashed. Have you seen these, Jared? Anyway, they're from this missionary called Lawton, and he collected pottery in PNG in the mid-20th century and wanted to send it to Tyndale at the South Australian Museum. He said, oh, I'm just worried they're going to get smashed on the boat on the way over. And Tyndale wrote to him, he said, don't worry, they will get smashed. Better that you smash them now and put them all in bags. So Tyndale instructs this guy to smash all this amazing Papua New Guinean pottery, and it's still freaking smashed. Like, we use it to train students in conservation how to repair pots. Every year another pot gets returned, which is... It's just one of those things. You look at museums and you think they're full of smart people who do sensible things, and every now and again someone just smashes all the pots.
Hey, don't try this at home, kids.
Well, maybe he realised it would be a future pedagogical tool.
Maybe. Let's be generous and offer that interpretation. It just seemed like one of those classically ridiculous things that you find when you're just not expecting it in museums.
And what about you, Jared? Do you have a dirty little archive secret? No. I think that's more than enough.
It's a bit more of the same. Yeah. Probably in more recent times, so I should probably not share it, really.
I'm curious now.
Just too dirty to share.
Let's talk about it in the green room.
Yes, their relationship of trust hasn't extended to that little morsel yet. Get pry it out of Jared later. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, folks. A huge, hot, feverish, COVID-safe hug to John and Jared for sharing the mic with us today. And a massive thanks to the Adelaide crowd who have come out to share the space with us today. For those of you who are there today, please run straight to that book tent over there without pass and go to pick up your copies of Jared and John's books. They'll be hanging around to sign them. You can also grab Eve and my books while you're there if you want. It's okay. For those listening in the pod world, you can find Jared's books via Magdabala Books and their website, and John's via the UWA Press website or wherever all good books are sold. And you can follow John on Twitter at JohnCardy77 and Jared on at JaredThomas_33. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of the seasons 1, 2 and 3 of Archive Fever via our website, archivefeverpod.com, and photos of all today's live action will be up there along with this episode, thanks to Lily.
And we'll be back in a couple of months with another Archive Fever live episode, the details of which are presently embargoed, but they're very exciting and we'll let you know as soon as possible.
And we are going to be bringing you another full season of Archive Fever later on this year. So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast, recorded today on unceded Kaurna land and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. Thanks for all being here.